May brings Teacher Appreciation Day and Teacher Appreciation Week. The events began when Eleanor Roosevelt persuaded Congress to salute the nation's educators half a century ago. But these days, budget woes and political struggles have left many teachers feeling distinctly unappreciated. NPR's Matt Coburn has the story.
This is Albert Einstein High School in Maryland, just outside the D.C. Beltway. It's hot, the A.C. isn't working, and by last period, the students are restless. But Melissa Paredes isn't cutting her class any slack.
Guys, we did have homework, so please take it out.
Paredes has been an English teacher for 11 years. She says she doesn't always feel appreciated.
I feel valued by my students, feel valued by my colleagues. But by American society as a whole, I would have to say that I don't.
She adds that if people really valued education, they wouldn't keep cutting teacher salaries or squeezing their pension benefits. Polls show teachers are popular. Back in February, an NBC Wall Street Journal poll showed that 73% of Americans have a positive view of teachers. That's typical, according to Andrew Coulson of the Libertarian Cato Institute.
Any time that you ask the public questions about teachers as individuals, you tend to get fairly favorable responses. The only time that you start to get negative responses are when the public is asked about teachers' unions and collective actions by teachers' organizations.
Remember that NBC Wall Street Journal poll that found 73% of Americans support teachers? It found less than 50% support teachers' unions. Along with other public employees, teachers have found themselves targets in the budget wars being fought in state capitals.
Obama and the union bosses are standing in the way of economic reform, intimidating taxpayers, leaving classrooms empty.
That's an ad run by the Republican National Committee during the budget battles in Wisconsin earlier this year. Again, Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute.
For a long time, the unions themselves were viewed in an indifferent way or a benign way even. Now the unions are seen quite negatively. It is only beginning to be the case that the public is transferring that criticism, that hostility, from the unions to the teachers.
Teachers' unions argue that teacher appreciation has fallen because of the campaign against collective bargaining for public employees.
I think we have a very active conservative group who have very loud microphones and a lot of ink.
Mary Bell is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. She says often people don't connect the teachers they love with teachers' unions.
They don't understand that those effective teachers that they know and that they respect are supported by a union.
But the union issue may be only part of teaching's image problem. The Gallup organization has long asked teenagers what they'd like to do when they grow up. Girls almost always list teaching as a favorite occupation, but boys are far less likely to see teaching as something they'd like to do.
So I think in this society, the profession of teaching is very gendered.
That's Sari Bicklin, a sociology professor at Syracuse University. She studies the history of the teaching profession.
It's not that all people who teach are women, but that the occupation was originally constructed around the idea of women earning a second salary.
Today, 8 out of 10 teachers in public schools are women, but most probably don't see their jobs as a second salary. Now teaching is seen as a lifelong career.
So we imagine a career where, you know, you start out at some rung of a ladder, you get more important.
But that's not necessarily true for teachers. They may continue in the classroom year after year without much sense of advancement, dealing with the struggles of students and with the conflicts and attitudes of adult society. Matt Coburn, NPR News.
If you're toying with the idea of growing some vegetables this summer, it's not too late to fulfill those latent agrarian longings and be seduced at last into becoming a gardener. Melanie Peoples has been thinking about how it happens.
Maybe you just can't help yourself. The weather has finally turned, and warm evenings draw you outside just to sit and breathe while the sun goes down. The smell of fresh-cut grass hits you, and you know it to be true. Summer is on its way. Off in the distance, a neighbor has fired up his grill, and the scent of something good to eat wafts over. Unable to resist, you slip the cover off your own grill, and as you wait for things to heat up, you start thinking about summer cookouts and what to put on that burger. tomatoes, you think, visualizing a perfectly rich red ripe one, not like the anemic pink ones you've been suffering through all winter. You remember driving past the tiny gardens starting to pop up all over town, in side and front yards, furrows being formed, the musky smell of freshly turned earth. And something in you stirs. Maybe you've watched the tomato-sharing scene from the movie Steel Magnolias one too many times. You think about your grandmother's funny-looking straw hat and find yourself studying your backyard thinking, what a waste of all that good earth. And the idea of letting another summer, a growing season by God, go by without making your own effort seems wasteful, irresponsible even. Never mind that you don't really like getting your hands dirty or fighting the bugs, but there's this nagging feeling that you're shirking your duty to grow something. You think about heading down to the nursery or hardware or home building store. The plants are everywhere. You cannot escape them. It seems like everyone is heeding the call. You'll just pick out one or two hardy-looking ones and plant them deep in the earth like your grandmother used to, or her mother before her. Each bit of dirt under your nails in homage to those who came before. Yes, you will do it. You will grow the tomatoes. And maybe some bell peppers, too. Have you seen the price of a red bell pepper lately? And right over there, carrots. This is how it begins.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Author Robert Penn actually can't remember the first time he ever rode a bike. He can't even remember his first bike, but he remembers pretty much every bike in the 36 years since then, from the purple Raleigh Tomahawk with tricked-out white tires to the mountain bike he rode through the Hindu Kush Mountains.
Today, I ride to get to work, sometimes for work, to keep fit, to bathe in air and sunshine, to go shopping, to savour the physical and emotional fellowship of riding with friends, to travel, to stay sane, to skip bath time with my kids. Sometimes I ride my bicycle just to ride my bicycle. It's a broad church of practical, physical and emotional reasons with one unifying thing, the bicycle.
Robert Penn owns six bikes, bikes for summer riding, winter riding, a mountain bike, a commuter bike, but not the perfect bike. And so he decided he wanted to build that bike, and he writes about that quest in his book. It's all about the bike, the pursuit of happiness on two wheels. And Robert Penn joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You are in our studios in Southern California. Did you ride your bike to the studios today?
Actually, no, I didn't. I did try and ride a bike across Los Angeles once, and I think once only, I think.
Not an easy feat.
No.
You are visiting the U.S. now. You live in Wales, and you live in a small village. You write about how you bike everywhere, and people assume that you did something bad because you're biking. They don't actually understand it.
Yeah, very much so. When I moved to that part of Britain, the local farmers regarded me with, well, suspicion, really. I mean, in the rural countryside, if you rode a bike as regularly as I did, which is every day, then something was clearly wrong. And after I'd been there about 6 months, I was up in my local pub on a hillside on the moor, and one of the very old farmers cupped me by the elbow and led me to the corner of the pub. And he fixed me with a stern gaze, and he said, "I see you on the bike, boy. So how long you lost your license for?" And the assumption was, of course, that I had no driving license, and that's why I rode a bike. And I tried to explain that actually, really, I rode it because...
Because you like it.
Yeah, because I like it.
You were looking to make the perfect bike. So what makes a perfect bike? What were you looking for?
I should qualify that. It's my perfect bike.
I got you, right.
I wouldn't presume to imagine that it's anyone else's. And in fact, I rather hope it isn't anyone else's, you know. But I was looking for a talismanic bike, a special bike, a bike that I'm going to ride for the rest of my life. Man-made in as much as that's possible now. I wanted a bike that somehow reflected my devotion to the machine. A bike that showed my appreciation of the tradition, lore and beauty of bicycles. And I wanted to get the bike that I'm going to grow old with.
This quest that you sort of, you know, went after, it took you back and forth across the Atlantic. You were in Northern California, and when you were there, you talk about meeting some of the guys who basically invented the mountain bike and mountain biking. Who are these guys?
So there was a small group who were fundamental to the invention of the mountain bike. And I met two of them, Charlie Kelly and Joe Breeze. And they're really wonderful, wonderful men. And the mountain bike, you would say, was invented on a footpath called the Repack, which is above a small town called Fairfax in Marin County. Mm-hmm. And if that's the birthplace of the mountain bike, Charlie Kelly and Joe Breeze were the midwives. In the early 1970s, they were part of a gang of young men who began modifying old single-speed cruiser bikes. Most of them were manufactured by Schwinn.
Right, like the kinds you'd ride along the beach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they began to ride these bikes downhill at full tilt on footpaths for fun. The clunkers they really weren't built for the task, but they were cheap and they were dispensable. And Charlie and Joe, amongst others, started modifying them. And what emerged from this synergy was the mountain bike, which completely revolutionized the industry. You know, someone famously said that the mountain bike saved the bicycle industry's butt. And I suspect that's probably true.
It saved the industry's butt because up until that point, what, they were racing bikes or these cruisers, and that was it. There was nothing in between.
Yeah, there was nothing in between. And the bicycle in both of those forms you just mentioned had drifted a long way from the original incarnation of the bicycle, a people's nag, a utilitarian, affordable, democratic mode of transportation. And then suddenly the mountain bike brought that back to the public again. It's like, here is a bike which is easy to ride, good fun, and cheap.
So part of this book is your quest to find the perfect bike. Part of it actually is a history of bikes, bicycling. And you've obviously done a lot of research on the history of bikes. And what I love about this book, and what I love about all the books we do on the program, is I always learn something. And for example, you say that in 1890 there were 150,000 cyclists in the U.S., and a bike cost basically half of the annual salary of a factory worker. Within 5 years, the price drops to just a few weeks' wages, and there are a million cyclists. So it's just this explosion.
It was an extraordinary explosion. There were a million new cyclists every year by 1895. It was absolutely rocket fueled. You know, Victor Hugo said, an invasion of armies can be resisted, but not an idea whose time has come. You know, the bicycle was that idea in the 1890s.
Yeah.
And it had all sorts of very dramatic implications. The geography of cities changed because people could now commute, and so suburbs began to be created. It had a huge role to play in the issue of practical clothing for women. It was the first popular athletic pursuit for women. And by the time the suffragettes movement was at its height in the 1910s, people looked back and recognised that the bicycle had been fundamental in the emancipation of women. It had a huge role to play in the Good Roads movement. A huge number of engineering discoveries or engineering innovations that the bicycle welcomed were borrowed directly by the automotive industry, which meant that an affordable car was realizable in this very short period of time.
I was amazed to read that a third of all patents registered at the U.S. Patent Office in the 1890s were bicycle-related.
I know. Isn't that extraordinary?
That's crazy, yeah.
It is extraordinary. The bicycle had its own patent office in Washington.
They can barely get the patent sorted out today. I can't imagine how they did it back then.
I know.
I want to get back to the perfect bike, the one that you built. The last thing you did was to have your bike painted, because you did finally get this built. You had it painted blue and orange, and then you write about agonizing over those color choices. When it was finally ready, you had it painted, you put all this time into it and expense. How did you feel? Did you actually achieve creating the perfect bike?
My perfect bike.
I got you.
I did. I mean, I take immense pleasure out of riding it.
Do you ride it a lot?
Yeah, I ride it all the time. It was very much designed to be a riding bike. It's not my uber expensive, super light race bike. It's a riding bike. So I've designed it to be roadworthy and to take a good hammering. So I ride it all the time.
So in your quest to build the perfect bike, right, you go to Northern California, you meet the guys who invented mountain biking, you find the person who's going to build the frame, you get all the component parts. How much did that cost you?
So it cost in total about $5,000.
Ah, that's not cheap.
It's not cheap, no. But I think I conclude in the book that it is the loveliest thing I've ever owned. And I think for $5,000, that's a pretty good deal. For a bike that I'm going to ride for 30 years, I think that's a pretty good deal. For something which is bespoke, handmade, and made to fit me, I think it's a pretty good deal.
That's the author Robert Penn. His new book is called It's All About the Bike, and it is about his love for cycling. Robert Penn, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Today we have news to share about our program. As you know, I announced my retirement last year, and at the end of the month, I'll sit in the host chair for the last time. Our news today is happy news. Audie Cornish will be the new host of Weekend Edition Sunday. No doubt she's familiar to you as NPR's Capitol Hill reporter and as a frequent guest host on this and other NPR programs. Audie's in the studio with me. Audie, congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's so amazing to be sitting across from you. Usually I'm filling in.
Well, I have to tell you, after more than 20 years as host of this program, I really feel that it's going to be left in very great and very capable hands. So I'm extremely pleased that you're the choice as my replacement.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, this is, of course, incredibly bittersweet for me because I'm such a huge fan. So, you know, I want to have you around the office to especially get some advice.
Oh, I have some advice. Big piece of advice. Get your sleep. My motto on Saturday nights is to be horizontal by 8 p.m. and unconscious by 9. And I think, you know, have fun with it. Be yourself. Let people know who you are.
Well, I have to ask, I'm a little bit of a type A personality, so I like to do a little research. And we found one of your first shows.
Oh, dear.
And I want to play at least just what we call the billboard, the opening of the show.
Okay. From National Public Radio in Washington, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. That is not me. I was never that young. On this day 207 years ago, John Hansen, no relation, was elected chairman of the Continental Congress.
Oh,
Susan B. Anthony was fined $100 when she tried to vote for Ulysses S. Grant.
Can you hear how nervous I was? I mean, my voice is at least two octaves higher.
Today is Sunday, November 5th. NPR's Jackie Leiden is standing by in New York City. We'll talk about
and
the man.
And what you don't hear is actually that interview that I did do with Jackie Leiden. It was the first thing in the show. She was in New York. And I said, Jackie, you know, thanks for joining us. And I started hearing this whine, this high pitch. I mean, we were getting feedback. And all I could think of to say was, I was expecting feedback on my first show, but not exactly this kind. I also want to tell everybody that you're actually going to be winding down your Capitol Hill beat, and you're not going to take the reins right away.
No, I'm going to take some time over the next few months to shake off the cobwebs of cloture votes and stuff I've been doing the last couple of years, and to build up some exciting things for the fall. You'll be hearing from me here and there, but I'll be back in a few months.
You'll also be back at the end of this month for my last on-air puzzle with Puzzle Master Will Shorts. Are you ready for that?
Yeah, absolutely not. I am going to be thinking about this every day between now and then and practicing. I will be there with number two pencils sharpened, ready.
Good for you. You'll do fine. Ladies and gentlemen, NPR's Audie Cornish, the new host of Weekend Edition Sunday. Thank you, and I wish you all the best. You're going to have a great time.
Thank you, Leanne.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. We're at the Main Avenue Fish Market in Washington, D.C. It's the oldest continuously operating fish market in the United States. And it's a fitting place to speak with acclaimed chef Barton Seaver. He's an advocate of sustainable seafood, and he's written a new cookbook called For Cod and Country, Simple, Delicious, Sustainable Cooking. Barton Seaver, it's really nice to meet you.
You as well. It's an honor to be here with you.
You open the book with a series of essays, and one, you lay out your philosophy for sustainable seafood. You write, "We fail to understand that fish are valuable as fish, not just as seafood." Will you explain what you mean by that?
Seafood is by and large how most of us interact with our oceans, and we've just grown to this very complacent point where we think that we're very much entitled to seafood, and part of sustainability is really understanding that fish are valuable to the ecosystem as well. They're a functioning and necessary part of how and why the oceans work, and they're not just there for our taking.
Well, we are in the middle of a fish market, surrounded by fresh shrimp and jumbo crabs and the octopus I saw. Why don't you show us, how do you shop for fish?
All right. Let's take a walk.
All righty. So we're standing in front of ice
contained flounder in the front, yep, and bluefish in the back. So what would you look for, say, in those bluefish in the back? How would you know that it's good?
It's a little bit of a toss-up. There's no universal rules, but I always look at the eyes. And on this one in particular, this bluefish, it's got nice, clean gills. The gills are nice and clean, free of that slime and the mucus that can form on them. But those eyes still look like they're looking at you, inviting you to dinner. Well, more or less inviting themselves to dinner is really what it's about.
Yeah, they are. Those eyes are looking right at me.
Inviting themselves to dinner.
What is Arctic char? I've seen it on menus. I have no idea what kind of fish this is.
Arctic char is one of my favorite fish. It represents one of the farmed species, aquaculture, that's really, by and large, done very right. And what I love about it, it's such an easy sell. I call it salmon light because it has that same flavor and color and that richness to it with a little bit less fat, so the flavor is a little bit lighter, a little bit more almost angular in a way. Wonderful cooking fish.
You have a recipe for Arctic char in your book, I believe. It's with cherry tomatoes and olive oil.
Yeah, you know, that's such an easy dish. Just a cast steel pan, a good amount of olive oil, a couple cloves of crushed garlic, season the oil with that garlic, get those flavors all in there and sort of permeating through the oil, a handful of cherry tomatoes in there, a couple of pieces of Arctic char right on top of the tomatoes, throw the whole thing under a very hot broiler. The skin of the char will crisp as the steam from the tomatoes gently cooks the char from the bottom side, and the tomatoes will burst open and sort of emulsify with that oil to become this thick, rich sauce that's just sweet and acidic from the tomatoes and fatty and rich from the oil. And simple meal, 10 minutes, no prep, done.
I'm going to have to apologize to our listeners for my stomach growling during this entire interview. You're such a poet with words about seafood that you've made me very hungry.
Well, luckily they have some fried fish sandwiches right over here. Maybe a crab cake.
Now, where do you stand on the farm-raised versus wild-caught fish?
One of the great questions of our time. I get that almost everywhere I go. Farm-raised species represent more than 50% of the seafood that we eat in this planet right now. They are not the only part of the solution, but they are definitely part of it. Some aquaculture is done poorly. Some of it is done in a way that actually helps to restore ecosystems, as is the case with farmed clams, mussels, and oysters. I think across the board it's our patriotic duty to eat as many of those as we can. I mean, environmentalism on the half shell with a six-pack of beer and a bottle of Tabasco, that sounds right.
Let's go take a look at some of those blue crabs.
There's some beauties over there.
Yeah.
See some of these crabs right here, and they're all after me. As soon as I put my finger anywhere near them, they want to pinch me. But some of these crabs are covered in seaweed, in growth, and that's from the overwintering. These crabs have yet to molt their skin. In a good year, a crab will shed its skin 4 times in order to grow, and that's where we get soft-shell crabs from. So this really represents the very first of the season's crabs.
Now, the difference is, I mean, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bins of crab uncooked here, and there's some cooked crabs down at the end. Medium, jumbo, large, quite a bounty here and very colorful.
Well, it's really interesting that you pointed out that there's a bounty here, because that is something that hides the impact that we have on our oceans. We don't see a fish disappearing until it's gone. Cod is in great trouble, and the stocks have plummeted to his unprecedentedly low levels, but yet there's still cod in the supermarket. And so the bounty in front of us often belies the real truth under the water. But in the case of the crabs here, over the past years, you see a real difference happening. Looking at these medium crabs here, the females, the bright orange tips of their claws, the males, the deep, dark blue Caribbean hue of their claws. But then look over at the large females. That deep red, rust-colored sunset on a romantic night on a beach, that's the color you're seeing. I haven't seen that color in 15 years, not since I was a little boy. Over the past decade or so, those haven't been around. We've been dredging them out during the winter, and they have never come to fruition. So to see that deep, rich red hue color of a big, large female that's breeding at highest capacity, that's a good sign.
You have a recipe for crab and corn toast?
Yeah, it's just crab simmered in a little bit of cream with some corn, the natural corn starches, thickening that cream, seasoned with Old Bay, put on top of a nice piece of toasted whole grain bread as a almost like a cream chip beef of the Chesapeake Bay, a creamed crab.
So what is the key to cooking seafood well?
90% of cooking good seafood is buying good seafood. If you don't buy a good piece of fish, there's absolutely nothing I can do, no recipe I can write, no tips, tricks, techniques I can teach you that will ever make up for that lack of quality. So a good fish meal starts right here at the market.
Think about the middle of the country, you know, where fresh seafood in terms of the kind we can get here in Washington is not available. How does one maintain a sustainable seafood diet in a place where there's not really that kind of fish?
Eating locally is a part of this dialogue, but it's not the purpose and it's not the whole lexicon of it. People in the Midwest, even people here in Washington, D.C., that cannot afford to come down and eat this pristine, fresh seafood or participate in this market. Crab meat, $24 a pound. King crabs, oysters. These are expensive. But sustainable seafood is available in the freezer aisle. Sustainable seafood is available in the canned fish aisle. Canned pink salmon, sardines, anchovies, canned mackerel make some of the most delicious and compelling meals that I think are in my book. And yet, these are accessible in every corner bodega, in every box store in America, in every convenience store, to everyone at every economic level.
We've been talking with Barton Seaver at the Main Avenue Fish Market. His new cookbook is called For Cod and Country. Thanks for the tour.
Well, thanks. I appreciate having you down in one of my very favorite places, the fish market.
For more ways to select and cook seafood sustainably, head to our website, npr.org.